From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. And just like that, it's September. Usually on Labor Day, we're gathering around the barbecue, celebrating one last gasp of summer before we settle into the routine of school or work. Our routines are not what they once were, but I hope you're still using this weekend to take a break from all the laboring, both the physical and the emotional. We could all use an escape. I'm using this week to take a beat and appreciate nature. Rebirth, rejuvenation, and regeneration. That's the message behind Fantastic Fungi, filmmaker Louis Schwartzberg's dazzling documentary about the magic of mushrooms. The film opens with noted mycologist Paul Stamets laying on the forest floor, which today, oh gosh, that sounds like a true luxury. From there, we go on an 80-minute journey that started nearly 90 million years ago. Hi, Louis.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
It's great to have you. In the movie, Michael Pollan claims mushrooms, quote, don't give a shit, unquote. How are they the ultimate omnivore's dilemma?
Well, because they can heal you, they can feed you, they can kill you. So you have to kind of think about what you're about to eat when it comes to mushrooms. And, you know, cows eat grass and, you know, monkeys might eat fruit. They don't have to think about it, but we do. And that's why I think there's such powerful foods or species, because something that can, you know, heal you, feed you, shift your consciousness, and even kill you has power.
Mushrooms are described as the digestive tract of the forest. How are we, humans, descendants of mycelium?
Well, we are descendants from mycelium because if you go back a couple of billion years, mycelium and fungi were here on the planet, you know, decomposing rock to create soil. And plants need soil in order to grow. Plants can take sunlight, turn it, you know, convert sunlight energy into food. Well, the mycelium, the fungi, they live underground and they do what we do. They have external stomachs where they eat organic matter and with enzymes break it down and absorb it. And we have internal stomachs. But genetically, our DNA is more closely related to fungi than it is to plants. It's one of the reasons why, for example, penicillin has saved more human lives than any other medicine in the history of mankind, is that the viruses that they combat are the same viruses that we have to fight in order to stay alive. And you being a expert in food, I'm sure you know that fungi live in your gut. And without fungi in your gut, you would not be able to digest food. And every time you take antibiotics, you have to replenish that garden in your gut so that you can absorb food, digest food, and break down food. So it's a beautiful symbiotic relationship.
What do mushrooms have in common with cheese and wine?
So mushrooms are the, what they have in common with the foods you just mentioned is they help with fermentation. They're helping to break things down, to convert them. So, you know, the fungi are starting that process of decomposition, changing the grape juice into wine. And then at some point we, I guess, stop that process and we drink it and we enjoy it. They make the food we need. I mean, without the fermented foods in our diet, we would have a hard time digesting food. So beer, wine, cheese, all are product of fungi creating a chemical reaction that's creating this cycle of life. You know, it's kind of interesting to think about. Is it the end of life or the beginning of life where fungi play a role? It could be the beginning of life because until you break organic matter down into their basic components, their basic molecules, that's when plants can absorb them and create food out of them. So it could be the beginning of life, as opposed to the end of life.
But aren't the end and the beginning the same?
It is. It's a circle. You're totally right.
Let's talk about the photography, which is absolutely just stunning. The film is like a masterclass in time lapse. How long did it take to get some of these shots? The decaying mouse, for instance, or...
Yeah, that was a beautiful shot, wasn't it?
Amazing.
Well, decaying mouse would be, I'm trying to remember now, probably 5 or 6 weeks. And it's a great shot of the mouse just like, you know, being disassembling itself and then grass growing. I've been pioneering time lapse since like 1972. And I've had cameras running almost nonstop, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 4 decades. And I've squeezed 40 years into about 20 hours of film, which is pretty remarkable. And the reason why I do it is because time is your most precious asset. And it just takes time to watch a flower open, a mushroom grow, or a mouse decompose. But it's a window into a portal of the universe that the human eye can't see. And I think what's powerful about that is that it opens your mind, your heart, your consciousness into the reality that there are many different, you know, forms of metabolic rates, of many different, you know, portals of life that we are unaware of. And so everything from like the slow time lapse of, imagine a redwood tree that would take 500 years to grow, to slow motion of a flea that might take 2 days of life. There are all these different windows of life that we aren't aware of. And we think that the human point of view of life is the only view. And when you realize that every living thing has its own time frame, its own way of dancing in the universe, then it engenders, I think, compassion and gratitude and appreciation for all living things.
In 2011, your film Wings of Life came out, which is all about pollinators and is narrated by Meryl Streep. How has the technology progressed since then?
Well, in terms of time-lapse, you know, it hasn't really changed a lot. And there's a lot of time-lapse flowers in Wings of Life. But, you know, it's kind of remarkable. I feel like I'm telling the same story over and over, because with Wings of Life, it's a portal into that beautiful intersection between the animal world and the plant world. You know, bee and the flower, where the bee, you know, needs pollen and nectar in order to feed its brood, its children. And in the process of doing that, it deposits pollen on that flower from other flowers, which then the flower becomes fertilized. And then we become the beneficiaries of this incredible fruit, nuts, and vegetables that enables us to have a healthy diet and a long life. And so pollination is like one portal into the mystery, or into the unveiling the mystery of nature. And then the mushrooms and the fungi world is just another portal into understanding these kind of incredible symbiotic relationships that are microscopic, that make the world go round.
The film ends with Paul Stamets talking about a paradigm shift in our consciousness that needs to happen to save the planet, saying that the core concept of evolution is mutual benefit and the extension of generosity, that communities survive better than individuals. I know that you did a series on gratitude. Could you leave us with a message about gratitude in the face of this pandemic?
Yeah. You know, I never knew that was going to be the end of the movie, this idea of, you know, that communities survive better than individuals, and that this mycelium network is a beautiful, wonderful example of that. And I think that with what we're going through right now with the pandemic, the thing that hurts the most is this feeling of not being connected with all the social distancing and everything else that's happening. We are social creatures, and we want to feel connected. Nothing in nature lives alone. And so I think at this particular period of time, one of the ways that we can deal with it is to take advantage of the fact that we have more time. We're kind of, you know, getting out of the fast lane and slowing down. And I think that if you can slow this perception of time down and become more present, to go into your garden and really look at a flower and the beauty of the colors and the aroma and everything it has to say, and observe that bee pollinating it, it just to become more present. And when you become more present, that engenders gratitude.
Thank you so much, Louis.
Thank you for the time to share some beautiful ideas.
That's filmmaker Louis Schwartzberg. His beautiful film is Fantastic Fungi. Watch it at fantasticfungi.com. Coming up, a glorious celebration of the taco on Netflix. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. It's no surprise that I listen to a lot of podcasts. I used to listen to them in my car, driving to and from KCRW, but these days I listen when I walk my dog or I garden. Many of you probably know that Samin Nosrat of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat fame launched a home cooking podcast when California announced the stay-at-home order. It's lovely, of course, because come on, it's Samin. But the Samin podcast that really struck a chord with me is an episode from Radiotopia's show Partners. The show opens with a conversation between Samin and Wendy McNaughton, the best-selling illustrator and graphic journalist behind the wonderful drawings in Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. I love their dynamic so much that I want to share it with you here.
I didn't actually really want to write this book. I was teaching cooking classes. One of the things I would always talk about is once you understand how salt, fat, acid, and heat work, that's at the basis of all good cooking. And Michael Pollan, who's my writing mentor, I taught him how to cook. And every week I would bring him a different book idea. And he would always be like, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad. And eventually he was like, you have this perfectly good idea. Why are you not working on salt, fat, acid, heat? And I was like, because that book won't have beautiful photos. I had been mulling over this book for a really long time. And to myself, I called it like an uncookbook. And I knew that it looked and felt different from any other book I'd ever seen. The idea is to free you from having to use recipes. So even though I love beautiful photography, photography was not the right thing for this book because this is about teaching and also making sure that people don't feel intimidated by one static idea of what a dish should look like. And also knowing my own self, I have a lot of trouble learning by just reading some words on a page. And I wanted to make a book that would work on a lot of different learning levels. And so pretty immediately I knew the solution was that it would be illustrated. And the only illustrator I could think of was Wendy because I stalked her.
I don't think I had ever heard of Samin before I got an email from Samin. What was the subject line?
You might be wondering, dot, dot,
dot. It was very enticing. And so I opened it. And inside I got one of, like, I would say the top two love letters I've ever received in my life.
Thursday, October 13th, 2011. You might be wondering, dot, 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 if I'm stalking you. Well, the answer is yes. I'm obsessed with your work. Obsessed. And I have a secret dream, about to be not so secret, that we can collaborate and that you'll illustrate the cookbook. Let's call it better than a cookbook, actually, that I'm starting to work on. Blah, blah, blah. I don't expect you to say yes right away, but perhaps we can meet and you can come experience some of my work. Come to one of my tartine dinners. Blah, 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 blah. I'm pretty certain that you are about to hit the big time and may already have other big book ideas in the works, but I'd be kicking myself for the rest of all time if I didn't even bother asking. So if you like, I'll show you my proposal when I'm done and you can let me know if you even have an inkling of interest. At any rate, I hope you're well. Ever so warmly, Samin. Wendy, at that time, one of the things I really loved about her work was all of these amazing charts and diagrams. And she would make these really funny and sort of thought-provoking Venn diagrams. So I made a Venn diagram of all of the ways that our lives intersected.
It was a beautiful email. It was very thoughtful. It was really detailed. It was clear, like, Samin had spent a lot of time looking at my work and was really familiar with it in a way that I wasn't used to hearing. Like, at the time, my work was on a small literary publication online called The Rumpus. And so some people had seen it, but I didn't think enough to get an email like that.
I mean, how creepy is that? She is like, I've never even heard of you. And I'm like, I know everywhere you've been published. I know this, that, and the other. Like, but there was no other person who could do this thing of conveying information, but not taking herself too seriously, being funny and silly and bringing whimsy and joy, which is all stuff that I want to convey in my message and in my cooking.
I got my graduate degree in social work. And something you do in social work is you literally make diagrams of people in their environment with their families and their economic systems and political systems and all this kind of stuff. And so I had never made diagrams before going to social work school, actually. And when I came out, that's where all those Venn diagrams that I was making and flowcharts and all that came from, was from mapping out social systems.
Creating hierarchies of information.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just to understand them.
I just was like, this is my collaborator. This is my person.
And we agreed to have coffee, and I think we hit it off.
You kind of said you were going to do it. Like, you were like, yeah, let's try this.
I mean, yeah. I think we had good chemistry, yeah, as they say. Like, we hit it off really well. And it was also clear, like, I mean, even though I hadn't heard of Samin, as soon as she started explaining, like, kind of, here's my story and here's what led me to here, here's where I worked and who I worked with and all of that. I mean, those names I was very familiar with and I was pretty bowled over. So Samin had been doing these dinners at Tartine where she would take over the restaurant for the night, and it was really limited space. And that kind of experience was outside of my world. She invited me to go. I brought my wife and we sat, and it was this amazing, beautiful communal meal. It was accessible, like, in a way that it wasn't fancy and off-putting. It was just delicious. And there was conversation about food, and like my mind started to open about the stories that are behind food. So it's not just like about this, you know, right, fancy stuff. So I got to know you, I think, also.
Yeah, and you drew me the first drawing you ever gave me.
Was that
at the
night?
Dinner? Yeah, you drew a picture of a turnip and you sent it to the kitchen.
At that point, I was trying to woo her.
Yeah.
You sent me letters. I sent you pictures.
Yeah. Oh, that was pretty good.
Yeah. I think that's something that we realized as soon as we met and started talking. We do not f*** around.
Yeah.
Like, when we work hard, and we are completely committed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a rare
thing.
That's
super important, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of collaborative mismatches I've had start with people who don't work like I work.
When you get two of us in a room together who have that ethos, that turns out pretty well, I guess.
Yeah.
It also turns out to take a long time.
A long time.
Yeah.
Well, I think for me, you know, I'd never worked with an illustrator before. I'd done plenty of, like, food magazine shoots and a little bit of video. And when you do that, you make the plate, you put it down, the person comes and takes 2 to 50 pictures of it. That could take anywhere from like 2 to 30 minutes. And then it's done. And then you move on next, you know, or whatever. And you're moving fast. And cooking is all about like efficiency and moving fast. And with Wendy, that's not how, and it took a big adjustment for me to understand, like, first of all, she has to stand there and draw everything in real time from the actual thing that I'm cooking.
Yeah, I draw from life. It brings something of the moment, like the line itself, I believe, captures the energy of the moment. So in order to do that, yeah, we had to spend a lot of time
in
the kitchen.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time together and going to the farmer's market, going to the store,
yeah,
like, yeah, in the kitchen, at the table. And, you know, and then she'd be like, don't move your hands. She'd be like, stand right there. You know, Wendy's a pretty fast drawer and she can draw without looking, which is amazing. Like, she can look at you and have her pen on the paper.
I mean, it's a messy drawing.
Yeah. But, yeah. And so she would draw this, and then she'd have to come back and take the reference photo so she could have the right angles and shadows and light and all that stuff. And then she goes to her studio and paints, which could take any amount of days.
I used to paint with oil paints, and that can be something that is very arduous and you can work at again and again. But watercolors, they dry instantly, and I don't work with a pencil, I work with a pen. And so once you hit that on the paper, you can't erase it. So you just have to deal with whatever unfolds in that moment. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, you have to throw it away and you either start over or you just work from the mistake and move forward from there. And I think that that is a lot like Samin's approach in the kitchen. At least that's what I've felt is like one thing that Samin said that made me feel like cooking was accessible was like, oh, don't worry, it's just dinner. Like if it burns or whatever, you know, you can just throw it away and you start over or you just use whatever's left over and make something new from it. Hopefully the artwork in there gives people a sense of not what something should look like, but maybe what something should feel like. So even if it's like a drawing of a green bean, like it should look like that green bean that Samin had just, you know, blanched so perfectly. But at the same time, it's a green bean that anybody can make, you know, and that anybody can feel like they could achieve. Luckily, Samin has taught so many classes and had worked with so many people in the kitchen. I think that me hovering, like, it didn't bother her at all. And it got a conversation going. And like I mentioned before, like, I had zero understanding of cooking whatsoever. So I would ask questions.
You were a gift in a lot of ways, because if I couldn't make you understand something,
yeah,
then how on earth was I going to make a reader?
Right, because I'm like lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
That was an excerpt from the podcast Partners, featuring Samin Nosrat and Wendy McNaughton, collaborators on the cookbook Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Partners is a MailChimp podcast made in partnership with Radiotopia and created by Hrishikesh Hirway. And now onto my favorite food group, tacos. Wrap it in a tortilla and call it a day. Everything works in a tortilla, and last year's 6-episode series, Taco Chronicles, highlights Mexico's most iconic versions through their history and the taqueros who have mastered them. Pablo Cruz created the series with Mexico City-based producer Hallie Davison on the ground in search of these taco aces. Hi, Pablo. Hi, Hallie.
Hello.
Hi, Evan.
So the series was filmed in Spanish with subtitles. And there are different narrators in each episode. In essence, each type of taco speaks for itself. It's simultaneously hilarious and moving. So whose ingenious idea was this?
It's a process that we went through to get to the idea, but I have to say it's mine. I mean, through the research of doing this show for a long time and wanting to convince Netflix, who was at the time the only place where food shows were getting any attention other than the ones that we know and yours, of course, on the radio. There was an evolution of going from, should we have a host? Who could be the host of a show that represents tacos? And, you know, some of the things that we thought weren't very good. So we thought maybe it's the taco who has to be the host and not have either an American coming to Mexico to try tacos or a foreigner to come and see how tacos live in Mexico, or a Mexican who will think that everything that we try is selling off. So we said nobody better than the taco itself to introduce himself to the world.
This series is really unique and stunning. You use the landscape as a way of anchoring us in the country. So the photography, the filmic nature of it is as grand as Chef's Table, but the landscape really sets you in place in Mexico. Can one of you talk to the place that tacos have in daily life in Mexico?
Tacos are daily life. You know, they don't have a role in daily life. They are everything. They're breakfast, they're lunch, they're dinner. They're absolutely part of the moments that are big and also the kind of small, more quotidian kind of movements of our days. Tacos are todo. Tacos are everything.
So each episode focuses on one type of taco with both culinary experts and chefs who weigh in with the backstories, whether they're geographical or historical, of each region. Does each type of taco that you focus on neatly pair with a particular region or city?
Oof, yes, 100%. I mean, each taco is a nation in Mexico, within Mexico. So somebody who is from Monterrey will argue
that their taco is something or another, and that the only taco that could be eaten for carnitas is from Michoacán. And even in Michoacán, someone will say that each town has its own taco. The same goes to carne asada. The same goes to the barrios in Mexico for tacos al pastor. Canasta, for example, which is a wandering taco. It's a little more difficult, but it has its birthplace for sure, which you can see in the show, and the families that created that taco and then made it available to everybody on a bicycle. So yes, the landscape also determines the taco you can eat, depending on what the weather is and the protein that is available whenever it's a protein. So you will have amazing carne asada tacos in Sonora because the best meat comes from there, and the landscape and the cows that live there are free roaming in the hills of Sonora with the heat and the cold. And yes, the tacos are a landscape in itself and define us as who you are and from where you're from, no? Defending that kind of micro identity that is only yours and that you perhaps only understand with the people from your block.
The Carnitas episode for me is one of the most incredible explorations of a traditional food I've ever seen. And part of that is because you go as far back to focus on an atelier that is making copper pans by hand in the most extraordinary way.
Yeah, that town is called Santa Clara del Cobre, you know, St. Clair of Copper. So its whole economy at one point was based on the production of copper, and specifically copper to make these, you know, gigantic pots to cook the carnitas. It was a very interesting experience filming there because we happened to be there during Dia de los Muertos, which is this, you know, huge regional holiday, and a lot of the ateliers were closed. So we had to work very, you know, closely with one of the ones that would be willing to, on his holiday, come and film with us and share his expertise. And I'm so glad he did, because I think it just adds so much to the episode.
Yes, it's extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. But for me, so much of the show really is, it's the people, the eaters, and the people who aren't the taqueros, but who surround the taqueros in giving service. Pablo, could you describe that one taqueria where the kids are running with the orders?
Of course. It's El Borrego Viudo. It's to someone who's from Mexico City and was born there and spent its teenage dash adult life of drinking or learning to at least have a beer, and then going back home and trying to be sober again to face your parents, it's an institution. El Borrego, it's the place where you will have to stop no matter what to have a taco. And they made a business out of being, Mexico City being a place where there's almost as many cars as humans, kind of like a drive-in of sorts where you park your car, you are with your girlfriend or with your friends, and by the way that you flash your lights and the way that you turn on the hazard lights, it's the signal for the taqueros to come. So if you want more water, you flash the, you know, you do flashlights twice. If you want more tacos, is the hazard lights once. And then the taqueros run to you. They know exactly what you want. They make sure that what you're ordering is what you think they were ordering. So it's kind of a reaffirmation of the code. They go back to the taqueria, get it, come running. You always take some back home, so they pack it for you. They, you know, they give you salsas to go. And it's a whole thing that later other taquerias, of course, embrace because it's unique. And there's better taco al pastor places if you want to try a more deep flavor. But El Borrego is an institution for sure, and it's just impressive. It's a thing on its own.
So, Holly, given this corona situation, what's happening with taqueros in Mexico?
Unfortunately, this pandemic is affecting all aspects of life in Mexico, and particularly the livelihoods of these taqueros who work on the streets. Most of them are in this more kind of informal sector. Some have, you know, more formal restaurant kind of establishments. But with this kind of, you know, stay-at-home order, not a lot of people are going out, and tacos don't travel super well as a to-go food. They're meant to be enjoyed mostly standing up in the moment, hot, fresh. That being said, there's a tremendous spirit of resilience that's always been part of Mexican culture. And there's a lot of solidarity and a lot of people who are trying to find ways to support their taqueros while they're not allowed to sell. There's also parts of Mexico City where life simply must go on. And so taqueros are continuing to do business. You know, this is their livelihood. So they're willing to take the risk that, you know, they might fall ill or get sick, but they see that as a better alternative to not being able to provide for their family.
It's hard to imagine Mexico City in particular without taqueros on every street.
Yep.
I just have to say, I just rewatched the series for the third time. And
thank you.
It's just fantastic and very, very difficult to watch if you're hungry.
Or if you're in confinement.
You already have to have a plan of where you're going to go to get your taco before you start watching.
Yes.
Thank you so much to both of you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
That was Pablo Cruz and Hallie Davison, creator and producer behind the Netflix series Taco Chronicles. In a minute, we travel to Italy and to the bottom of the sea in two beautiful new documentaries when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Anybody can make anything one time perfectly, but can you make it 10,000 times perfectly? That's a question Evan Funke posed in his Quibi series, The Shape of Pasta, which finds the chef traveling through Italy to discover the history of its cuisine and the rarity of some dishes created with flour and water by the hands of the women of Italy. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm just so jealous. This is such a dreamy series.
Isn't it? I'm so fortunate and so grateful for the opportunity to sit with these extraordinary women and these extraordinary places. And it's watching it now during this time. It's kind of like a time capsule almost.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, it really is comforting. It makes you realize there is a world out there that is still wonderful and that we still want to visit. How did you go about choosing 8 shapes of pasta when there are just thousands?
it was really difficult. And a lot of it had to do with our research team, along with myself, you know, whittling it down to 8. And it came down to logistics, whether or not these ladies had the ability to sit with us or really wanted to. And we finally whittled it down to these 8 extraordinary shapes with great stories and amazing women that still practice them today. But we really wanted to kind of sandbag the list with a couple of quasi-recognizable shapes like agnolotti and trofie, and then sprinkle in some really extraordinarily rare and obscure ones like rashketeli mishkedu.
I just think that the women are so extraordinary. And since it seems like all of them started learning their craft when they were 5 or 6 years old, watching hands that are that practiced is just such a pleasure. So let's start with the rascatieri di Mischiedu, which comes from Teana, this tiny town of 600 people. What region are you in with this one?
So this is Basilicata. And really, when you drive up into Teana, it's perched on a top of a couple of low mountains. And I think a high percentage of the inhabitants there are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And it's kind of this epicenter for a very practiced and rhythmic way of life. We got the opportunity to see a few of these towns with 412 people, 600 people, 1,000 people. And it's almost like traveling back hundreds and hundreds of years in time. You really get a sense of how truly difficult life is on the top of this mountain, how hard won every kilo of semolina flour that they have has been harvested by hand in a very rugged landscape. And that goes for the vegetables that they grow and everything else.
One of the things I love about this shape, which I've been lucky enough to see made in situ, is the combination of using grano duro, durum wheat, and fava flour, which of course has its history in total misery. But this shape sort of celebrates even that, which I find wonderful. Can you describe the shape, what it looks like, and then the move you have to make to create it?
So difficult. So difficult. So I still have real difficulty forming this shape because it takes so much technical feel and practice to get this thing right. And like you mentioned, the fava bean flour makes it that much more difficult because fava bean flour is almost like a paste. There's no gluten in it whatsoever. So it makes the dough extremely sticky. And the basic sequence of forming this pasta shape is almost like, what's that game? Shuffleboard. Okay. You're in a bar, shuffleboard, and the shuffleboard has this, those little small silicone roller balls that make the puck slide. It's almost like that, where the semola provides this sliding surface for the pasta shape, but you're pressing down with an extraordinary amount of pressure and allowing what gluten that's actually present in the shape to curve around your fingers in two to three different sections. And because the piece of dough that you take off of the snake is so large, you're able to form these rather, you know, 1-inch by 3-inch pieces. And they're huge. They're huge.
They kind of look like a cross between a potato chip that has a great deal of inside and a snowshoe with these amazing divots created by each individual finger pad.
That's a very good description, a snowshoe. I like that a lot, a snowshoe.
One of the aspects of the show that I really enjoyed, and I guess it was part of the self-selection of women who were willing to do it that you talked about at the beginning, is their joy actually in teaching you and their humor as they're coaching you along. So in particular, the woman that you made the agnolotti del plin with.
Yes, Gemma.
She's just fabulous.
Just blew me away.
Let's talk about, describe the pasta. Because we've all heard of agnolotti, but these are different.
Sure. So agnolotti, there are two separate forms of agnolotti. Del plin and then agnolotti, which is essentially the same thing. It's a self-sealing ravioli. The only difference between the two, the fillings are the same. The difference between the two is the plin is pinched on the side. And in America, I think that the agnolotti has gained some visibility through Thomas Keller and Wolfgang Puck, et cetera, et cetera. Any restaurant that needs to fill a hole in their menu, they throw on agnolotti because it's kind of like this buzzword for ravioli. They're fairly, I would say medium level difficulty to produce, especially if you're using a pasta machine to sheet it out. It's very, very easy to do, but rolling it as Gemma rolled it, which we have to talk about her mozzarella.
Oh, and the size.
Oh my God. These things were bazookas.
Did you order one?
No. I've talked with her since, and I haven't really gotten a straight answer of where I could get one, but I'd never seen the double mozzarella technique, number one. And number two, I'd never seen mozzarellas with that amount of girth. And the way that she uses one as a ballast as she rolls out the sfoglia in front of it, it just blew my mind.
I just want to say that mozzarella means rolling pin.
Yes, mozzarella. It was also 105 degrees in her lab. We were in Italy during the heat wave, so it was so hot, and we were rolling handmade pasta in 105 degree weather with the windows open and all that. So we had to work fast.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Thank you.
That's Evan Funke, author of American Sfoglino, chef at Felix, and host of Shape of Pasta. You can find the 8-part series on Quibi. Uni, the butter of the sea. Luxurious, sensual, and delicious. But look at the spiny outside of an urchin, and you know there's a deep story into how it gets to us. Jason Wise is the producer, director, and co-writer of the documentary, The Delicacy. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. It's great to have you. Tell us more about just the experience of eating uni. What is it exactly we're eating?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways to answer that. I think biologically, it's pretty easy to answer. You are not eating their eggs. You are actually eating their gonads, which both males and females have. But yeah, it's the sex organs.
And how would you describe the taste of it or the experience of eating it?
This is another one that's part of the reason I wanted to make the film is because of how difficult a question this is to answer. The one thing I think everybody can agree on is that it doesn't taste like anything else in the world. And the way people used to describe it is often words you wouldn't associate with food. I mean, Andrew Zimmern says it tastes like copper penny and it's one of his favorite flavors. I mean, you don't hear that kind of a thing for a normal food. I would say that it tastes like a very strange combination of salinity and the smell of the ocean, meaning if you're walking along the beach and it's pulling away from the sand, kind of a smell, with cotton candy and a strange fattiness that is, it's a viscous, almost like an olive oil kind of a tannic fatty flavor. That is, and that's why it's such a difficult thing to describe. I guess that's the best I can do.
What is the Southern California relationship to uni?
So there are a couple places in the world where the best sea urchin from a standpoint of fanatics comes from, and one would obviously be Japan, but the Channel Islands in Santa Barbara, there is an incredibly rich environment for all sorts of different animals, and one of those is the sea urchin. At first, and we get into this in the film, that abalone was the commercial fish out there, the commercial fishing industry. But the relationship with sea urchin in California goes back nearly 100 years. It was mostly Asian immigrants and Chinese and Japanese populations who were really found out how delicious the urchin was from this place. But the relationship now is, it is a massive business. It's considered one of the greatest places in the world to get this food.
So we've covered the collapse of the abalone fishery several times, but the result of that collapse was that there were a lot of expert divers who pivoted. Could you talk a little bit about that's part of the story?
Yeah. When the abalone industry did collapse, and at that point it switched to a very small amount of non-commercial diving, those divers, they all sort of were prepared to figure out how do we forage something else underwater. And part of the amazing thing was not a lot of Americans, traditional, you know, your general, what you would think of Californians at the time, were eating sea urchin. Abalone had, you know, 60, 70 years from Carmel down south to establish itself as this interesting food item, you know, in burgers and everything else. But when it comes to abalone, its appearance is much more, I would say, palatable to, and this is generalizing the typical American type of California palate. When you look at a sea urchin, it is a very, very strange looking animal. And to get inside and eat it is even crazier. But these divers, they realized that they needed a job and need to keep their job. And there was a large, mostly immigrant Italians, Japanese, Chinese populations, Greek for the most part, that would eat these things. And they didn't realize how bustling of a business it actually was. So a lot of these abalone divers, they did pivot into sea urchin as a fishing and a money-making opportunity.
In The Delicacy, your movie, the divers that you mostly spend time with are these crusty surfer dudes in their 60s now. and then there's Stephanie Mutz.
Yes.
Can you talk about how the way she works is different from the way they work?
Stephanie immediately, and there was a lot of reasons, most was necessity, had to figure out a different way to sell her urchin. Because the market would crash every once in a while and Japan would stop bringing in urchin, and all of that urchin goes through a processing plant. So they bring the urchin in, I guess you could picture truckloads or big basket loads, and they're all broken down by a group of people who then put them on those wooden trays that you see in sushi restaurants as those little orange-looking tongues. And Stephanie, she was very, very smart to start using social media. She was very plugged in, and she started using social media and realizing people would buy the entire animal, the whole urchin, not just this broken down, beautiful little bamboo thing. And she really went out to try to sell it as a product to people individually, you know, right directly to the consumer. And it's revolutionary.
And individually to restaurateurs, which I think is probably the core of her business. So the restaurateurs aren't buying through a middleman. They're buying directly from the harvester.
That's correct.
What are the dangers for divers down there trying to pry these little guys or find them?
Well, it's such an unnatural act to do this. I think one of the things that's so fascinating about the film is you get to see they're not fishing. Fishing is just a term for what they do. They don't have rods and they don't have nets. They physically go down with these tongs and pull the animals off of the ground. And they often don't know if the animals are down there until they go and check. And if you think about all of the things that can go wrong in a swimming pool with scuba diving gear, let alone in a place with, you know, the Channel Islands in that area are notorious for a couple things. One are great white sharks. There are many. But the real danger probably comes from the currents. There's currents that pick up and they're unpredictable, and it has to do with the islands being, you know, a separation for the currents. And it's very dangerous. And then also you have kelp. And there are a couple different kinds, but there's this kind called pearl kelp. And when you get caught in that, it's a very difficult prospect to get out of it without, you know, and you have to remain calm. And I think all the divers themselves have had run-ins with all kinds of wildlife and all kinds of kelp and things like that. But it's oftentimes staying calm is the most important thing. But those are some of the major, major scary things that I think they face on a daily basis. But your equipment can malfunction. It's there's so much unknown. Humans are not supposed to really be underwater.
It's really fascinating, the movie. It shows this whole hidden world of not just the ocean, the greatest hidden world, I think, on Earth, but just this world of harvesting and selling that we don't see when we get, you know, something that's touted to us as like the bomb with tons of those little uni tongues on it.
Yes. Yes, it's definitely, there's a disconnect there for sure.
Well, thank you so much, Jason. It's a lovely film.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
That was Jason Wise. He's the producer, director, and co-writer of the documentary The Delicacy. Coming up, Indian food and a Bollywood movie. Sounds like my perfect Saturday night. Stay close. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. All day on today's show, we've been getting lost in films and podcasts, and so I wanted to take the opportunity to revisit a segment from 2017 that is, for me, the epitome of delicious escapism. Shri Rao is a screenwriter and home cook, and in his book, Bollywood Kitchen, he pairs home-cooked Indian recipes with Bollywood films. I am a voyeur at heart, not just of food, but of just daily life and culture in other parts of the world. And so for me, Bollywood films scratch that itch in a major way.
They are larger than life. They are a spectacle of color and emotions and drama and music. They're really fantastic.
And you kind of have to learn to surrender to them because some of them are really long.
Yes, they can be. They are getting shorter now, but historically, yes, they've been easily over 3 hours.
And there's always a ton of food in them.
Of course, because Indians love their food just as much as they love their movies.
Tell me a little bit about the role of the Indian movie industry in an expat Indian's life. When someone emigrates, there must be a role that Bollywood movies play that's so important.
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing to understand is that films for all Indians, particularly in India, is a way of life. I know that we here in America think that we're really crazed with Hollywood and our movies from Hollywood go all around the world, and that is absolutely true. But we haven't seen anything compared to Indians and how much they love their films. Films really are like a religion there, literally, so much so that some of the very popular actors are revered as though they were demigods in small towns and villages across India. You know, traditionally, many Indians are lower income. You know, hundreds of millions of people live under the poverty line in India. And movies for them are their only sense of escape, you know, a way that they can transport themselves to a fantasy world where they see people and places that they might not otherwise experience in their lives. And so it's not just for poorer people, but for all strata of society in India, films are a primary form of entertainment in that country. And so for people who came to America, like my parents did in the 60s, they brought that tradition with them. And when we talk about the role of Indian cinema in Indian Americans' lives, there's another layer that is added onto it. So not only, you know, are we Indian and therefore love our films, but we're Indian American. And that means that for my parents, for example, when they came here, it was very difficult for them to go home in the first 20 years that they were living in America because it was so expensive. And at that time, it was very difficult to travel internationally. These films were the only sights and sounds that they had of home for years at a time. So they really held a very emotional place in their lives as immigrants.
Give us a sense of the movies and food in your home growing up. Was it the situation where you would have a movie like just streaming or screening in the background while everybody gathered at the table? Or did people sit on the couch with food on their laps and watch?
Well, they are really two separate experiences because Indians take their food very seriously and they take their films very seriously. So you really need to devote and be fully present for both experiences. So growing up in my house, and I'm from a small town in Pennsylvania that was 99% white and Christian, and we were one of the few Indian families in the area. Growing up in my house, there were just a couple of constants, and one was that my mom would prepare a very elaborate Indian home-cooked dinner every night, and we would sit down as a family at 6 o'clock to eat dinner. For us, that was sort of a sacred time around the dinner table, and then there was a follow-up sacred time to that, which was the movie that we would watch after dinner. That was our opportunity to come together as a family and watch these films, which is the way that I, as a kid that was born in America, is the way that I learned about my culture and my heritage. It's the way I learned the language. It's the way that I learned the customs. It's the way that I learned about the music and the dance and the different types of storytelling that my parents grew up with.
What I love about this book is you really go into depth, like a film critic, about the movies. So I'm going to just tell you that last night I went on to YouTube and I watched Door. D-O-R.
Oh, great.
So the food that you chose to pair with Door was a chicken curry.
Right.
And Brussels sprouts with peanuts. Tell me a little bit about these two dishes and why sort of that movie inspired them.
Sure. So Door is this beautiful little independent film. Door means string. And it's the story of two strangers, two women who come from very different walks of life, who are connected to each other through a very dramatic sequence of events. And that's sort of the story, the relationship between these two women as they come together and their lives intersect. The film takes place in the deserts of Rajasthan, which is this beautiful scenic area of India, which is deserts. And I wanted the meal to be rustic in the same way. It should feel very hearty and simple and a humble meal. And the chicken curry recipe that I included in there is sort of the quintessential home-style chicken curry dish. It's the kind of dish that you could make around a campfire in the deserts of Rajasthan. It's the kind of dish that we made in my house growing up in Pennsylvania. Every single Indian household has that classic chicken curry, which is chicken that is braised in some sort of a tomato sauce. And with this chicken curry, I wanted to pair something that was bright and fresh, and that's why I chose the Brussels sprouts.
Give us a suggestion from the book that would be Bollywood 101, a movie that's not a cartoon, that shows like a depth of character, but is just super engaging and entertaining.
Bollywood is not just one thing. Bollywood is a lot of different genres, and that is the thing that I try to demonstrate in the book. There are horror films, there are dramas, there are comedies, there are epic period dramas, there are films for kids. One of the films in the book that I would say is a good one to start with is a film called Bajirao Mastani. And that is a historical epic drama that came out, I believe, 2 years ago. And it was directed by a master filmmaker named Sanjay Leela Bhansali, who directed another epic film called Devdas, which is also in the book. And Devdas was the first Bollywood movie to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. This film is really well done and is a great place to start because it has an excellent story. It's about a kingdom in ancient India and about a soldier, a general who falls in love with a woman but is married to another woman. So it's this epic love triangle. It's dramatic and romantic. It has amazing song and dance numbers. The production values are out of this world in terms of costumes and sets. It's a great story. Priyanka Chopra, who many people may know from Quantico, stars as the wife in this story, so that there's another way in. That's one of the good ways to be introduced to Bollywood, Bajirao Mastani.
And what's the food that you pair with that?
With Bajirao Mastani, I pair a chicken korma, which is a chicken dish that hails from the Mughal Empire. The Mughals were the Muslim rulers that invaded India. And that is sort of the time period of this film, Bajirao Mastani. I wanted to evoke those flavors in the meal. Traditionally, chicken korma is a very rich chicken curry that is made with cream and nuts and raisins. And what I've done with that dish is I've streamlined the recipe and made it a lot healthier and a lot more accessible for American home cooks. So I use thin-cut chicken breasts, marinate them and grill them very easily, and then on the side, create a cream sauce that's actually made with yogurt. So it's actually very healthy and just as tasty as the traditional version of the recipe.
Sri Rao is the screenwriter and home cook. We've been talking about his book, Bollywood Kitchen, home-cooked Indian recipes with Bollywood films. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, as always, you can always listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. I have so much gratitude to the Good Food team during this time. Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Kat Yore, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. I hope you too are taking a moment to zone out this weekend. Make some chicken korma and watch Bajirao Mastani. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.